Hello, and welcome to Can't Make This Shit Up, a true crime podcast. I'm Cassie, a true crime enthusiast.
And I'm Mark, her dad, a true crime professional, currently a traffic homicide detective in South Florida.
And we hope you guys enjoy. The day has finally arrived.
Dun, dun, dun.
We've talked about it a lot in past episodes.
Okay.
So I'm going to make good on a past promise.
All right.
Today is the day we begin our coverage of Al Capone.
All right.
So this is definitely going to be a multi-parter because Al Capone did a lot of crazy shit.
I was gonna say, he did a lot of shit. A lot of shit.
A lot of shit.
A lot of shit.
So I got the majority of my information from a very good book. It's called Al Capone, His Life, Legacy, and Legend. And it's by Deirdre Baer. I'm going to link it in the show notes, of course. So if you're interested in reading it, you can find it there. She actually interviewed many of Al Capone's family members, and they gave her access to a lot of personal family documents. So I think it's a pretty accurate and thorough description of his life, or at least as accurate and thorough as we can get, given the circumstances.
Right, right, yeah.
So here we go, part one. Al Capone's father, Gabriel Capone, first came to the United States from Italy in June of 1895, aboard the ship Wera. It was with his wife, Teresa. So Teresa was pregnant. They already had two sons, Vincenzo and Raphael. So it was Gabriel, Teresa, Vincenzo, Raphael, and Teresa was pregnant.
Okay.
So they were from a small village just outside of Naples, and they were the first from their family to travel to America. Gabriel was trained as a baker, and he paid their voyage through his work. Unlike many Italian immigrants at this time, Gabriel knew how to read and write, and he also spoke a little bit of English. So impressive for that time.
So he could read and write Italian.
A little English.
And a little English too. Okay. All right. So he was like one up on most everybody who was coming over.
Right.
Okay.
Upon arriving in New York City, Gabriel settled his family into an area of Brooklyn known as the Brooklyn Navy Yard. It was here that Teresa gave birth to their third child, Salvatore. This area was crime ridden and known for gang activity. Although Gabriel was a gifted pasta maker, he had difficulty finding a job as a baker in Brooklyn, so instead he became a barber. Both he and his wife Teresa worked hard to save up the money for Gabriel to buy his own barbershop. So on the side, he was also working at a grocery store, and his wife was working, taking in piecework.
Okay.
Finally, in 1899, Gabriel purchased his own barbershop at number 69 Park Avenue in Brooklyn. And the family began living above it. On January 17th of the same year, their fourth son, Alphonse, was born.
Okay.
Following Alphonse, the couple had five more children. Yeah, so they had a lot of kids.
Really? What was that, like total of what, 10?
They had 9 children altogether.
See, I never even knew that about him, that he had that big of, you know, that many siblings.
They had Alphonse, which obviously goes on to be Al Capone.
Right.
Then the couple had five more kids after him. They had Erminio, Umberto, Amado, Erminia, who unfortunately she died at a few months old. So, and then the youngest was Mafalda. While all of the children were given traditional Italian names, they chose to go by more Americanized nicknames as they grew older. So the couple's fourthborn, Alphonse, became known as Al Capone. While growing up, Al spoke broken English because he grew up in a neighborhood made up of so many immigrants that all spoke different languages, and he only spoke Italian at home because his mother barely spoke English.
Oh, okay.
It was reported in the book that Teresa was a strong disciplinarian, while Gabriel was not so much. So basically, Teresa kind of wore the pants in the family.
That's true of a lot of Italian families. My very good friend, he grew up in New York, ironically, and they were from... Oh, they're from Naples also. And Mama was a tough cookie. She used to lay down the law. So
yeah, and we'll see throughout that Teresa plays a big role in Al's life. His mom's like his numero uno.
Gotcha. Okay.
Because the Capone family was wealthier than a lot of their Italian counterparts in the neighborhood, they were extremely well respected within the community, and they were known as Don Gabriel and Donna Teresa. So very Italian.
Yeah, that's already, I guess, a lead into the organized crime, maybe. That's terminology used in the mafia or the, you know.
After becoming a citizen in 1906, Gabriel moved the family and his barbershop to a better area of Brooklyn on Garfield Place. This neighborhood was also more traditionally Italian. However, they lived on the neighborhood's border, so they interacted a lot with Irish immigrants. So they kind of lived on the border of the Irish neighborhood and the Italian neighborhood.
Okay.
Although both Gabriel and Teresa valued education and honest work, and they attempt to instill these values in their children, every single one of their sons quit school before graduating, and every single one became involved in criminal activity in one form or another.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Which is pretty crazy considering that they lived like a very honest life.
Right.
However, out of all of their sons, Al was the only one who became extraordinarily successful through his life of crime. He was also the only child to consider himself fully American rather than Italian. As an adult, it was reported that he would get extremely angry when anyone referred to him as Italian, and he would say, quote, "I'm no Italian. I was born in Brooklyn."
It's true. He was born in Brooklyn, so.
By the age of 8, Al had already earned a reputation for his fighting skills among the neighborhood kids. One altercation in particular has become a part of the lore of Al Capone.
Okay.
And these are the true recollections of that event, according to the actual family members that were there.
Okay.
A group of Irish boys within the neighborhood began sexually harassing Italian women when they would leave their homes. So these boys were basically little shits. They would run up behind these women and they would sneak up to them and pull up their skirts so that they could see their legs and bloomers.
Jeez, okay.
So in addition to this, these boys began damaging Italian property too, and basically stealing from homes. And
right.
During this time, Al ran with his own gang of Italian boys, and they referred to themselves as the Boys of Navy Street. In addition to Al, the gang consisted of Frank Nito, who would later become Al's enforcer, and another
Nito
Frank.
Or Needy?
There's a Needy and there's a Nito.
Oh, okay. I don't know. All right.
So Frank Nito, that's the one that later becomes Al's enforcer.
Right.
He also ran with Frank Needy, who he was 18 during this time, which is a little weird because why is he hanging out with 8-year-olds?
Because birds of a feather? I don't know. Like,
I mean, that's a little weird, like at 18 to be like palling around with 8-year-olds.
Yeah, it is. But if you think about modern day gangs or like the gangs in LA and from the movies and documentaries that I've seen, you know, you grow up in the neighborhood. So you kind of, if you move into that, I guess, that tradition or move in, you know, towards that way of life, the old guys kind of teach the new kids and, you know, they recruit them young to bolster their numbers. So maybe, you know, maybe had to do something with a little bit of that. And, you know, again, if they're all criminals, they kind of, you know, all hang out together and run in the same circles, even at 8.
Yeah. So we'll see that this little like gang they've started, it's not really, they're kind of just wannabe gangsters at this point. They're not actually recognized by like the true gangsters in the neighborhood. It's just kids that are trying to be like,
we're just hanging around together. And right. Okay. Yeah.
So the boys, in order to combat these Irish guys, the boys stole a washtub from one of their neighbors whose name was Mrs. Adamo and strapped it upside down to Al's front. The older gang members instructed Al to beat the washtub with sticks, essentially becoming the gang's drummer as they marched into battle to fight these Irish kids.
Oh, my Lord. So
legend has it that while drumming, Al chanted, "We are the Boys of Navy Street. Touch us if you dare." And he kept screaming it over and over. Once they met up with the Irish, all the boys began fighting while 8-year-old Al stood in the melee, continuously beating his drum and chanting his song.
Wow. Okay.
So I could just picture that in my mind.
A little 8-year-old boy just beating on a metal pot or metal bowl or whatever it was.
Right. So following the fight, the boys returned the washtub to Mrs. Adamo, which I was like, wow, at least they gave it back.
Yeah.
And Al's reputation was cemented as a foot soldier within the gang.
Okay.
Surprisingly, despite his violent reputation, Al performed very well in school. He was intelligent and learned to speak fluent English quickly. He rarely got lower than a B in school and was known to be very good at arithmetic, which we'll see that plays in later.
Yeah, I was going to say that was part of his being able to move up the ranks and take over because he was way more intelligent than a lot of the people that ended up working for him or, you know, becoming part of his gang or mafia or whatever, you know.
Right. However, despite his natural intelligence, he played hooky often and rarely attended class. He was known to say that he learned more on the streets than he'd ever learned in a classroom.
I believe that.
Me too. In addition to his smarts, Al was also large for his age and had a reputation for having a short and violent temper. By the age of 10, he appeared to be 16. Al was between 5'10 and 6 foot tall, which was tall compared to the other Italians in his neighborhood. During his prime, Al also weighed between 200 and 250 pounds and was known to be pretty muscular. So he was a big boy.
He was a big boy, yeah, for back then, for sure.
Despite his size, he was known for his quickness and agility. At around the age of 10, there are tales of Al and his gang hanging out at the gates to the Navy Yard looking to pick fights with sailors that were coming off the boats.
Holy shit. Okay.
At like 10 years old, he was like, come fight me, bitch.
That's definitely a big 10-year-old if he's looking to fight men, grown men.
As legend has it, he would pick fights with sailors twice his age and would often win.
Damn.
On many occasions, the police were called, and Al was so quick that the police could never successfully catch him.
Okay.
Once Al was 14, all of his extensive absences from school eventually caught up with him, and he was told he'd have to repeat the sixth grade. Rather than repeat the grade, Al decided to drop out of school completely instead. There are two versions of the story of his final day in school, and both are kind of equally ridiculous.
Okay.
So we don't know which one is true, but I'm going to tell you both of them.
All right.
During his final day at school, another student stole Al's lunch. Upon discovering this, Al stood up in the middle of class, disrupting the teacher's lesson, and demanded that his lunch be returned to him. There were two different versions of what happens next. So that part we know for sure happened.
Okay, wait. If he's, 14 now?
This
is happening when he's 14? Okay, so if he already has this reputation at 10 of fighting grown men and beating them, who in their right mind would want to take the man's lunch?
Somebody did, and Al was not going to fucking have it.
Damn. All right. That's a classic case of stupidity. Sorry.
Correct. So in one account, the teacher punished him for his outburst by demanding he go into the coat closet and face the wall, which, you know, that sounds like a common like thing from back then. They all did stupid shit like that, making him wear the dunce hat and stuff.
Dunce cap, yeah.
Which Al refused to do and walked out of the school for good.
Okay.
In the other version, the teacher stood between Al and the other boy, and basically Al kicked the teacher's ass and the boy's ass.
Ah, I'm going to believe that one because I like it better.
I like it better too.
I like it better. Although I will say, I'm going to say this, we'll probably laugh and things that he's done, but he was a true animal and criminal. So
yeah, some of the stuff he's done he's like monstrous.
Yeah. Sure.
But we'll see. He is very much kind of a conundrum in the sense that he does a lot of good things, but then he does a lot of horribly evil things. And it's hard to kind of compare the two. You're like, how is this the same guy?
Right. He was a monster. He had people killed. But yet you wanted to see what happened next. It's crazy. I don't know. It's like people want to like the bad guy, but, you know, the bad guys are still bad. So.
Well, and there are certain aspects of the story where you're kind of like, oh, Al, you're so Al. But right. Then there are other parts where you're like, dang, you're just a fucking asshole.
Yeah. Yeah. He definitely did a lot of bad shit, which I'm sure we'll get to. So
upon quitting school, Al's parents did not discipline him, but they did expect him to go to work and begin contributing to the family financially. Back then, Italian men and women did not leave their family homes until they were married. At first, he did work legitimate, honest jobs. He got work at a candy store, a bowling alley, and at a printing plant. During this time, Gabriel became aware of the Navy Street Boys and worried that their fighting and commissions of petty crimes would get Al into trouble. Al also began hanging out in social clubs within the neighborhood, which further worried his father. As a result, Gabriel purchased Al a shoeshine box and encouraged Al to get into the shoeshine business. He directed Al to set up his box in one of the busiest spots on Columbia Street under a big clock. Although Gabriel was trying hard to ensure that Al stayed on the straight and narrow, his shoeshine business actually ended up having the opposite effect, because it was in the spot that Gabriel had suggested that Don Battista Bellizzamo, who was known as the first godfather of Brooklyn, It was on that street that he and his men conducted business.
Oh, boy.
As Al Shine's Shoes, he would watch Belisamo's men make their weekly rounds to the local merchants who would pay them for quote unquote protection in order to conduct their business within Brooklyn. This inspired Al to get into the same line of work. Al began insisting that the other shoeshine boys on Columbia Street pay him for his protection or else.
Right.
He enlisted the help of two of his cousins, Charlie Fischetti and Sylvester Agagolia. Okay, there's a lot of Italian names in this. I want to apologize in advance if I butcher any of them. I'm doing my best. He enlisted the help of his two cousins, Charlie Fischetti and Sylvester Agagolia.
Agagolia, there you go. Sylvester Agagolia.
And two of their friends, Jimmy D'Amato and Tony Scrappacetti. So he enlisted their help to collect the payments. And the five began referring to themselves as the South Brooklyn Rippers and began recruiting other boys to their gang as well.
Okay.
While their protection racket worked for a time, eventually Belisamo caught wind of it and kicked the boys off of Columbia Street. During this time, Al's older brother Ralph had moved to Manhattan and began doing odd jobs for a gang called the Five Points Gang, which was known for auto theft. Al began hanging out in Manhattan with his brother and soon became affiliated with another gang known as the 40 Thieves Juniors. You can't make these names up for these gangs.
Well, the Five Points Gang is actually it was a popular gang.
It was through this affiliation that Al became acquainted with the crime boss, Johnny Torrio. Al was immediately impressed with Torrio, who was known to be a snappy dresser and was reported to never commit crimes himself, but instead had his minions commit them, making it nearly impossible for him to be charged with any crime. By the time Al turned 16, he was working with Torrio in his office, helping him run numbers. Allegedly, before hiring Al, Torrio tested his loyalty by inviting him to wait in his office with a pile of cash in view. Torrio wanted to see if Al would steal from him, but as legend has it, Al left the money untouched and thus won Torrio's trust. Torrio paid Al well for his work within the gang, and Al handed all of the money he made over to his mother each week. His mother knew the money was not from shoe shining, but asked very few questions about its origins.
Yeah, when you got a lot of grain rolling in, sometimes you don't want to know where it's coming from.
From the beginning, it seemed Torrio took a special liking to Al, as he would never allow Al to witness any parts of the gang's activities which were violent. He also would never allow Al to go into the brothels in order to collect payments, although he had no problem sending other boys his age to do so. It was as if Torrio was trying to protect Al in some way. However, as Al grew and proved how great he was with numbers, Torrio began giving him more and more responsibility within the gang. While working for Torrio, Al developed a love of dancing and would spend his time off in Italian dance halls. He was apparently quite the dancer.
Wow, I never knew that about him either.
He had some happy feet.
All right.
No women were allowed in these dance halls, as it would have been detrimental to their reputations. So men would dance with other men in these dance halls because, you know, back then it was frowned upon for women to behave that way.
Oof. So
it was basically just these clubs where men would get drunk together and dance.
All right, then.
Al soon became known as a superb dancer and began frequenting non-Italian dance halls so that he'd have the opportunity to dance with women. Because, you know, in the Italian community, it was frowned upon, but not so much in necessarily other ones.
Right. Anywhere else, right.
Al developed a reputation as a womanizer and would sleep with any woman who came his way, including sex workers.
Okay.
As Al got older, Torrio began splitting his time more and more between New York and Chicago. While he was gone, Torrio began entrusting a lot of his New York business to Al. Al sold and transported guns, which he carried in brown paper bags. He also carried out threats and beatings for Torrio, and he began making hits for Torrio as well.
Oh, okay.
By the time Al turned 18, he'd already murdered at least 6 people at Torrio's request.
Wow, okay.
The one criminal activity Torrio refused to participate in was drug dealing. While working in a box factory in 1917, Al met Mary Josephine Coughline. She went by May, and she was working in the office as a timekeeper. Al was 18 and May was 20, Her father had recently passed away due to a heart attack, and May had taken the job in an effort to help her family financially. Al was instantly attracted to her and she to him, although it was an odd pairing for the time because May was Irish and Al was Italian, and they often, those two did not mix back then.
Absolutely not, yeah.
May was beautiful, with thick brown hair, green eyes, and a big smile, and Al was first attracted to her physically. However, after getting to know her, he found she was smart, and they shared a lot of the same interests. Perhaps most importantly, May shared his love of dancing.
Okay.
Following meeting May, Torrio directed Al to begin working for another mob boss known as Frankie Yale, who had just opened a bar in Coney Island called the Harvard Club. He needed a trustworthy person to work as a bouncer. After working successfully as a bouncer for a while, Al eventually worked his way up to becoming a bartender. While working one night at the Harvard Club, Al told a female patron that she had a nice ass. The woman's brother, in an attempt to defend his sister's honor, broke a bottle and sliced Al across the cheek, although some claim these cuts were made with a knife rather than a bottle. This resulted in 3 scars across his face, and as a result, Al developed the nickname Scarface, yep, which he hated.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
It turned out the man who cut him was also involved in the Torrio Yale gang. So rather than fight the man, Al was directed to apologize to him for insulting his sister. Despite his scars, May was undoubtedly attracted to Al, as they would hook up secretly at work. So they were getting it on before they were married.
Okay.
Which, well, back she, then.
She is Irish.
Is that what they say that they're?
No, no, but because she wasn't Italian, you know, they were more, I guess they were, correct, I don't want to say looser, but I think they were a little bit more lenient in their extracurricular activities. So,
yeah.
You know.
Eventually, May became pregnant outside of wedlock.
Oh, boy.
However, despite the social judgment of the time, the two did not immediately marry. May had their first child, Albert Francis Capone, at her mother's house, where she was still living on December 4th, 1918.
Okay.
Following his birth, on December 30th, the couple finally wed. So they actually waited till after she had the baby to get married.
Wow, okay.
Allegedly, their wedding took so long to occur because May's mother was against a mixed marriage. She wanted May to wait to get married in case the baby didn't survive.
Oh, okay.
Although when it did, she pressured the couple to put the baby up for adoption. However, they refused. And with Al being criminally connected, May's mother was too frightened to really do anything drastic.
Yeah. Who's going to speak out about them having a child out of wedlock?
Right. Although I'm sure his mom didn't like that.
No,
but being like a strict Italian like mother,
that's,
you know?
True, yeah.
Well, her and May never get along.
Okay. Well, there you go.
Like, they deal with each other because they're in the same family, but they don't, you could tell, okay, they never liked each other.
Right. Okay.
However, following the marriage, Al eventually won over May's mother, who loved how devoted he was to May and that he helped support the family financially. Following their marriage, May continued to live with the baby in her mother's house, while Al was attempting to live a more honest life now that he was a husband and a father. So he took a job as a bookkeeper for a business in Baltimore. So basically, he moved to Baltimore to try to go straight.
This is from New York, right? He hadn't made the move to Chicago yet.
Right. He was in New York. He moved to Baltimore to take this bookkeeping job, and he was sending May all his money.
Okay.
But May was still living with her mother.
Right. Okay.
It's unclear why May and the baby didn't accompany him to Baltimore. Al did not return to live in New York until a year later, when his father died from a heart attack in 1919.
Oof, okay.
Following his father's death, it became Al's responsibility to support his mother and his younger siblings, who still lived in the home on top of the barbershop.
Gotcha, okay.
And then he also had the responsibility, of course, of supporting his wife and baby. He was only 21 at this time. So Al moved back to Brooklyn and once again returned to Johnny Torrio and Frankie Yale for work in order to make ends meet. It was at this point that Al moved into his mother-in-law's home with his wife and Sonny, his son.
Right.
However, working for Torrio, Al was rarely home and would sometimes be gone for weeks at a time. He would call his mother in May every single night. During this time, one of Al's main jobs was collecting money from the brothels Torrio owned and operated. And he was told to, quote, make sure the prostitutes didn't get out of line. While doing this, Al frequently slept with sex workers, and it was eventually discovered later on that he not only gave his wife syphilis, but had also passed it on to his son because she had had it while she was pregnant.
Oh, okay.
They both unknowingly suffered with the disease for years until they later moved to Chicago and eventually figured out they had it and received treatment.
Right. Wow.
Here is how Johnny Torrio took over Chicago. His cousin was Victoria Morsco, who was the major madam of an area in Chicago known as the Levee. She owned and operated about 100 brothels in the area. And she, yeah, that's a lot.
That is a lot.
And she was married to a man named Giacomo Colosimo, who went by Big Jim.
Okay.
So Big Jim owned a restaurant, which was a front for all their criminal activity. And it served as a way for them to legitimize the money which they received from all their criminal enterprises.
Gotcha. Okay.
The couple and their gang controlled the Levee area and in 1909 requested that Torrio come to Chicago to deal with some of the rival gangs who were attempting to extort them. Some of these gang members were mysteriously murdered and others were persuaded to leave Big Jim and his wife alone.
Imagine that.
A year after Al's return to Brooklyn, Torrio decided he wanted to move to Chicago permanently rather than travel between the two cities. However, when Torrio spoke to Big Jim about moving, Big Jim was not happy.
Really?
In response, Torrio hired Frankie Yale to kill Big Jim so Torrio could take over his territory in Chicago.
Wow. Okay.
So basically, Big Jim called Torrio in and was like, I need your help. People are trying to steal my business. Torrio scared everyone off, then killed Big Jim himself and was like, bitch, I'm taking over your business.
Well, I didn't let him move over or move in, so.
Torrio wasn't having that.
The price of business.
On May 11th, 1920, Big Jim was murdered in his restaurant in the middle of the day with patrons and his staff inside.
Jesus.
Despite all of the people inside, no witnesses came forward.
Shocker.
And Yale was never arrested for the crime.
Imagine that.
Following Torrio's Chicago takeover, Al initially stayed in Brooklyn and continued to work remotely for Torrio. And also continued his job as a bouncer at the Yale Club. Whenever someone owed Yale money, Al was sent to deal with them. It was during this time people truly began to fear Al Capone, as rumors of his murders had begun to spread, and he, quote, never hesitated to bash heads. Despite Al's reputation, he got into some serious trouble one night when he was out collecting money for Yale. A rival gang member from the Irish White Handers, named Arthur Finnegan, made an offensive comment about Irish women who marry Italians.
Oh, boy.
Al flew into a rage and beat Arthur so severely that he nearly died. One of the Irish White Handlers' leaders, Wild Bill Lovett, swore he would murder Al in retaliation. As a result, Yale sent Al to hide out in Chicago with Torrio in order to protect him. So Al packed up his wife and his son and moved into a small apartment in Chicago where he began working exclusively for Torrio at this point.
Okay.
Upon arriving in Chicago, Al worked managing several of the brothels Torrio had stolen from Big Jim. Soon after, Al bought a 2-family home and sent for the rest of his family to move to Chicago as well. In 1921, Al was promoted within Torrio's organization and began working at the Four Deuces, a nightclub and brothel run by Torrio.
Okay.
At the Four Deuces, Al became the bookkeeper. So his main job was to launder all of the illegal money through that business.
Okay.
So basically, he kind of does, if you've ever seen Ozarks, he was doing...
their scheme.
Their scheme, right. Okay. Except instead of a casino, it was like a nightclub.
Right, okay.
By 1924, Torrio took a trip to Italy and left Al in charge while he was away. While he was away, Al kept rival gangs at bay and put his brother, Ralph, in charge of, quote, physical enforcement.
Oh, yeah? Okay.
His brother, Frank, was put in charge of the politics of running the gang, such as doling out bribes, rigging elections, that sort of stuff.
Okay.
During this time, an important election was taking place within the town of Cicero, a suburb of Chicago where Torrio had moved a lot of his business to. Al was determined to get his bribed officials elected. In order to do so, he had many of the opposing party's workers and candidates beaten. He also had his henchmen stand by the voting boxes, inspecting each voter's ballot, And if the voter had not voted for Al's candidates, they were threatened with a severe beating until they changed their vote or left without voting at all.
Wow. Okay.
And he does this throughout his career. Like, he fucks with the voting of all major local elections.
Right. Okay.
The Chicago mayor was made aware of what was going on in Cicero and sent plainclothes officers to investigate. When the police arrived in black sedans, Al's brother Frank happened to be outside and reached for his weapon. All of the officers opened fire, killing Frank and starting a gun battle. The shootout ultimately killed not only Frank, but two of Al's other men and two citizens who just got caught in the crossfire.
Oof, okay.
Somehow in the melee, Al escaped unharmed.
Oh, he was present when this was happening.
Yeah.
Okay.
Also, during 1924, the murder of a man named Dean O'Bannon resulted in many rival gangs wanting to retaliate against Torrio. As a result, Torrio was rarely seen in Chicago and hid out in Arkansas, Florida, Cuba, and even the Bahamas. Because of this murder and their frustration at not being able to find Torrio, one of the rival gangs attempted to assassinate Al Capone. As he was entering a restaurant for lunch on January 12, 1925, a rival gang opened fire using a Thompson submachine gun in a drive-by shooting. Al dove to the floor and managed to come out unharmed, but his car, which had been parked out front, was riddled with bullets. This was the first time a Tommy gun was ever used in gang warfare. Isn't that crazy?
That is crazy.
That's like what you associate with, like...
He made that shit popular.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, back then, like, Prohibition and all that stuff, that's what they used. That's...
Ironically, it became Al Capone's favorite weapon. So it was the first weapon that was used against him, and it became his favorite weapon.
Imagine that. Talk about him embracing that suck or that horror.
Yeah.
I'm gonna turn this bitch around and use it on you, mother effers.
The irony.
It's crazy.
For some reason, despite this attempt on Al's life, Torrio returned to Chicago a few days later, and on January 24th, 1925, while walking with his wife, two rival gang members, Jaime Weiss and Bugs Moran, jumped from a vehicle and opened fire on Torrio. They shot him several times in the torso, but did not attempt to shoot his wife. Bugs Moran attempted to shoot Torrio in the head, but his gun jammed, and he and Jaime took off in the car.
Wow, okay.
Incredibly, Torrio did not die. He was rushed to the hospital and survived his wounds. He refused to tell police who had shot him. When interviewed by a committee which was convened to investigate the shooting, Capone swore he did not know who the shooters were. However, when asked, quote, would you tell us if you did know? Al said, quote, no, I value my life too much to tell if I did know.
That's it.
Torrio spent 1 month in the hospital recovering, and Capone had armed guards outside of his room and slept himself on a cot inside the room with a multitude of weapons. However, upon leaving the hospital, Torrio was sentenced to serve 9 months in jail as a result of the previous charge in which he'd been arrested, which was for operating a brewery.
Oh, geez, okay.
So basically, they couldn't get him on anything serious, so they got him on operating a brewery, because this is back during Prohibition when you weren't allowed no alcohol, so... During his prison stay, Capone continued to run the gang in his absence. When Torrio was released from prison in 1925, he decided to retire and move back to New York. It was at this point that Capone, at 27 years old, officially inherited the Torrio Crime Organization, which by that time had become known as the Outfit.
Okay.
At this point, the Outfit was making an estimated $105 million a year, which in today's currency would be about $1.7 billion.
Jeez Louise.
A year in cash.
God bless it. That's good money when you can get it.
now you know why Mama Capone wasn't asking no questions.
$1 billion a year. Jesus.
That's almost two.
Yeah. Yeah, it's closer to two than it is one.
Torrio claimed that he had no choice but to retire because he was, quote, getting too prominent for my own good.
Wow.
So that is where I will leave you for part one. And next week we'll pick up at part two and we'll talk about now old Al's in charge.
Yeah, Al's taking over Chicago.
Hell yeah. Yeah, it was interesting researching it because, you know, you always associate with Al Capone Chicago. And I didn't realize that he was actually born in New York.
And he's in New York. I didn't know that either. I thought he was always from Chicago.
Me too. We have one question.
Okay.
So this, I honestly don't even know what my answer to this is. Annie asked this question. So hi, Annie.
Hey, Annie.
The question is, what is the craziest thing you've ever seen?
Me?
I think both of us.
Oh, okay. You first.
Oh, fuck. Well, I got to think. I mean, you have definitely seen far more crazier things than I think I have,
yeah.
But.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of shit, unfortunately. Because down here in South Florida, I mean, it's everywhere, but, you know, being a police officer for 27 years, unfortunately, you're going to encounter and have to deal with a lot of stuff. So to pick one thing, I do have a crazy story, and it reminds me of a case that I actually worked. This was probably back in, I'll say it was like 16 years ago when the first time I was a detective, and I just worked general investigations. And I actually had a police officer who worked for one of the smaller municipalities was going home one night, and I was on call, and he was carrying his weapon. He literally parked his truck in front of his house. And when he got out of the truck, I guess he didn't have the weapon on him, so he took it out of the truck and went to put it like in his waistband to take it inside. And for some reason, the gun went off and shot one of his testicles. And he shot right through his testicles. And his testicle was laying in the grass. So naturally, we had to handle it. You know, it was a shooting. And because it wasn't a death, the homicide bureau didn't take it. So me, who was on call, the general investigations detective, had to take over the case. And I have to say, the department he worked for, like when I got on the scene, they had left the testicle there.
Can't they put that back in?
Yeah, well, that's what I thought. And apparently not. It was too destroyed. And they were like, So
they just left it in the grass?
Well, they took him, and then, you know, we called fire rescue back, and then fire rescue came and took it to the hospital. And then, so the long story short is that his department, which is a small department, but turned out to be a very good department. The chief of police showed up to the emergency room that night. You know, I was there because I had to do my investigation and stuff, and put him like on duty status. Like it was an on duty shooting. Like he got shot on duty, which was good because it covered his, but they crucified him with jokes. And it was like, which is the, you know, that's just the kind of the humor that we have, but like he couldn't live it down. So he went into surgery or whatever. And then a couple of days later, I went to visit him at his house and to make sure he was doing okay. And they were sending him like flower stuff with like, you know, testicle stuff. And like, it was,
hope your testicles are feeling better.
Yeah. Like, so I can only
get well soon.
It's like, that was the last time I had contact with him. Cause I closed the case out because it was a simple case, but I had to document it. But I'm sure that when he finally went back to work, I'm sure that first roll call was probably like, how are your balls? Or, you know,
I hope he already had all the kids he wanted.
How are they hanging? I don't know. Like, well, no, he was a young guy. So I mean, he wasn't married or anything. So,
well, he still had one good working one.
Still got one good working one, but it was, so that was crazy investigation I had. And
when I was in high school, there was this guy that one of our friends dated. Do you remember Sierra?
Yeah.
So Sierra dated him, and long story short, he ended up being a complete asshole.
Okay.
And he only had one ball because I don't know. I forget like the reasoning why, but he only had one ball. Okay. And we forever since then, we refer to him only as the Uniballer. <That's awesome. laughs> Wafa and Raquel, if you're listening, remember the Uniballer?
That's how nicknames, you know, like. Like,
which,
Jimmy,
I know that sounds really mean, but this guy was a dick. He deserved it. Okay.
Fuck him. Sometimes, you know, you earn nicknames. So,
well, I don't have anything gruesome per se, but I guess I would say that one of the craziest things that I've been through is in college. I lived at one point with this girl, and I won't say her name, but she was just nuts and she did a lot of crazy shit. But for an entire school year, she lied and told everyone that she had cancer.
What?
And long story short, it ended up all being fake.
Wow. Wow.
Isn't that
that's
nuts?
Bad. That's bad.
She, yeah, for like an entire school year, she was telling everybody, like her boyfriend, everybody, that she had cancer, and it was all a lie.
Oof. Wow. Okay. So there you go.
So at the end of last episode, when I edited the show, I put in, after the music, I put in a little secret spass.
Oh, yeah.
And I wonder how many of you guys actually like listened all the way through and heard it.
Like a little Easter egg thing?
Yeah. It was after the end music. So all I wonder how many people listened all the way through. Let me tell you now, guys. Sometimes I put in a little Easter egg. So you might want to listen through the song. But yeah, remember how you got attacked by the cat last time we were recording?
I did, yes.
I cut that part out and put it at the end after.
Damn cats.
Okay, so until next week, bye.
Bye. Boom, boom, boom.